Chapter 5. Picture a lonely human sleeping fitfully atop a cold marble slab in an alien cemetery, his dreams threaded by a night-long threnody of the undead, a crooning zombie serenade. How restful would you find that, after a long hard day getting pummeled by bourgeois werewolves, seeing your comrades snatched away by cloaked figures in the night, and then losing even the distant comfort of contact with your starship, orbiting far overhead? Would your slumber be fitful? Disturbed on this night of the living dead? Not mine. For the rest of that long first night on Oxytocin 41, I slept like, well, the dead. Somehow, knowing that my new friends, Mulder and Sully, would guard me until dawn, protecting the most precious thing that I had left, something the two of them no longer possessed, life. The next morning's weather was perfect for my kindly hosts, dank, chilly, and overcast, but not too humid. An ideal sort of day for recents, the newly risen dead, to stroll into town. We had to wait, of course, for the great zombie conclave to break up after that strangely stirring night-long dirge. The literally haunting harmonies at last began to fade along with the brittle constellations when a pale morning glow spread in the east. Gradually, through a pre-dawn mist, shambling figures could be seen descending through the graveyard, returning to tombs and crypts and cenotaphs, then pulling shut their hinged lids, leaving behind a trampled slope scattered with various organs, limbs, and other fallen parts, twitching, then dissolving into sludge and vapor. A few of the oldest walking cadavers, nearly fleshless and evidently confused, wandered past the tombstones and monuments, moaning softly as they meandered toward the dim city skyline, heedless of a minefield that lay in the way, just short of the town wall. A staccato of muffled explosions made me wince, but Mulder, the male Zoom, who had befriended me last night, grunted with satisfaction each time a detonation resonated through the rows of tombs. "That's how I plan to move on when the time is ripe," he commented, with a bang. "None of that soul a-whimpering from me." A final coffin lid slammed shut, even as the mist condensed into swirls and then clouds that drifted upward, revealing the resplendent skyscraper towers of a city that had been named, until yesterday, Kalmari. In this light, the metropolis looked pretty typical for a Stage 18 world, only with some unique features. For example, a maze of netting, like spiderwebs, making it next to impossible for any creature, alive or undead, to fly between most buildings. One of the many defensive measures erected by the planet's living population, I supposed. Perhaps paranoid, but understandable, given what I had learned so far. The city proper was a realm for the planet's most numerous subspecies, known as standards, sufficiently humanoid that an Earthling like me could walk among them. At least, that was what I hoped to do, with help from the substantial makeup kit that my other new friend, Sully, carried with her at all times. "We'll have to change your skin tone and put some box corners on your ears," she commented while applying putties and sprays. "Oh, and let's give you a nice goatee beard to cover up that awful chin." I stopped myself from blurting, "What's wrong with my chin?" Even with nano-translators tuned to the local language, I had to assume there would be, well, exaggerations. So I quashed any impulse to take offense. Besides, she had a gentle touch and was by far the most attractive corpse I had ever met. Sully even made a few alterations to my Alliance uniform, sewing some of the rips and tears from my battle with local lycanthropes the night before, then adding a few clever touches to make my clothes resemble normal street attire. Mulder, pacing nearby, grumbled that she was putting in far too much effort. "It's not as if he'll really blend in. Have you forgotten we'll be with him?" Mulder had just finished puttying his own face, but only in a very dark room would anybody fail to note a missing chunk of skull, perhaps the very injury that brought him to this place, to his second phase of life. "Oh, hush," Sully responded. "Don't you want the flavor of a good deed to carry with you as memory and mind fade away?" Mulder muttered some more. But, of course, this merely confirmed something that I've long observed during my voyages aboard the Clever Gamble. For all of its apparent malignity, the universe also overflows with kindness and skill. Anyway, I just have to believe it. A character flaw, I suppose. They only pick optimists to serve as human advisors aboard demi-crude ships. Anyone else would probably go insane. Our day began with a hurried search of the big park where my crewmates and I had slurried down to this planet only a day before. I held out little hope of finding the nozzle intact. After all, I couldn't see the hose. A careful scan of the sky showed no blue, shimmering line leading upward to the heavens. Still, I had to check. If our ship had been destroyed, the nozzle reconstructor should still be there, along with a tangled coil of fallen tubing that would trail ever westward, falling from space to snarl trees, power cables, and clotheslines across half a continent. The nozzle was gone. No sign of it in the park. And in a sense, that was encouraging. So the gamble hadn't been destroyed in a flash. There must have been time to at least begin hauling in the slurry hose. A small comfort. Very small. Our search brought forth one more clue. A tattered tunic of lime green, very large, with WEMS spelled across the chest. I turned it over carefully, checking for clues to what might have become of the security crewman, but there were none that I could see. Then I tried using the garment's built-in transmitter to contact Commander Talon on the Clever Gamble. No luck. My ear nanos conveyed only space static. Something terrible must have happened to the ship, because my crewmates would never leave comrades stranded below for so long. Say what you will about demis, but most of them are loyal to a fault. I've got to find out what's going on. No choice, then, but to head into the town proper, accompanied by Mulder and Sully, in order to seek aid from one of the local dignitaries, the apparently renowned Professor Ping. I had to revise my earlier notion about social arrangements in the city that only yesterday, without the inhabitants' permission or knowledge, was renamed Squid. So far, I had encountered 4 subspecies of humanoids on this world, commingling in a complex life cycle, with some of them treating others as prey. A place where, as I've said, paranoia seemed quite justified. Nevertheless, the various types weren't at war, not exactly. True, the city showed signs everywhere of profound efforts at self-defense, like those huge, ominous nets spanning open spaces. High concrete walls, topped with razor wire, ran along the riverbank, dividing downtown from the park cemetery area, turning the broad stream into a moat. Watchtowers overlooked several gated bridges. Yet, despite the backdrop of predation and mutual mayhem, It was remarkably easy to enter the city proper. No one stopped us, or even scrutinized passers-by, as we ambled across one of the spans into the main commercial zone. At the city end, formidable barriers had swung aside on hinges apparently unneeded by daylight. Motor traffic rushed past us in both directions. I wondered, could the local interspecies asperity be limited only to night? Was it simply a matter of bad luck and demi-impatience that Captain Ohm had a slurry down to this metropolis so late in the day? Standards swarmed the streets and canals of Squid City, busy at trades and industry, making and buying and selling things, bickering, talking, raising their young, doing all the normal things of civilization. Yet, amid the throng, I also glimpsed a few of the predatory types, always given plenty of room by the standards who stepped aside out of reflex, as if the protection of daylight could only be trusted so far. A lordly Nomort strode past one side street, smiling nonchalantly and frighteningly, with sharp, demi-like teeth, his aristocratic black cloak drawn up into a hood for protection from the sun. Later, we turned a corner and almost ran into a pair of hirsute lycums with trails of drool dangling from their lower tusks. I cringed for an instant, fearing that the larger one might be Besh, the wolfish leader of a band that had imprisoned me and beaten me in the herb. But no, unlike Besh, these two were well-groomed. In fact, their combed and coiffed facial fur was perfect. As we passed, I overheard a snatch of raspy speech. It was only a moment, but they seemed to be in heated discussion of some kind of sporting event, almost like a couple of regular guys on a street back home. Apparently, on oxytocin, death wasn't like the sudden on-off transition back on Earth, or that I had seen on so many countless other worlds. An either-or thing. Till now, I simply assumed it was a law of nature. Only here, life had stages, complex, unpredictable, filled with change and nuance. Moreover, evidently some kinds of afterlife rated higher than others, while the rare Nomorts moved through town like aloof nobility, and Lycums had the apparent tastes and temperaments of middle-class monsters. Clearly, the poor Zooms got no more respect than that accorded to ghoulish proletarians. Though my two lifeless friends had made great efforts to fit in with all that putty and lacquer, they got only curt and disdainful looks from citizens in prim, high-collared business suits hurrying by on their way to work. Standing at a curb, waiting for the light to change, Mulder seemed especially unpopular. Normal folk edged away, pinching their noses. I soon learned more about this prejudice when Sully asked if I was hungry. "Starving," I replied. "I suppose when we get to Professor Ping's..." She shook her head. "Carefully, of course. The prof is absent-minded. He may not have stocked up for himself, let alone a guest. We should bring something." She gestured to an establishment on a commercial street, a grocery store, apparently, with commodities stacked on shelves, bottles, boxes, and cans, mostly. "I prefer to shop at Walmart," Mulder commented. "Half of their employees..." "That's at the other end of town, and we should hurry along." Now I caught scents that churned my stomach with hunger pangs. Normal landing party procedure calls for detailed tests before consuming local food on an alien world. But right then, possible allergic reactions seemed the last of my worries. "I'm afraid I haven't any money." "That's okay," Sully assured. "I had savings when I died, and no heirs but a brother who insisted I take it with me. Fat lot of good it'll do me soon. So, use this." She held out a purse. I heard clattering non-metallic coins. Anyway, you must do the buying for us. Why's that? She pointed. A man wearing a stained apron stood in the doorway, glowering at our little group. To his right, set prominently in the window, stood a sign which nanos in my eyes set to work translating, overlaying the alien typescript with demi-letters that seemed to hang ghostly in space before me. No shoes, no shirt, no pulse, no service. Lycan served until noon only. No eating, drinking, or howling on premises. No morts, strictly cash. Underneath, a second, smaller sign bore a caricature of a zombie with one eyeball hanging out of a socket and both disjointed arms outstretched before it. Jagged slash marks across the figure translated as forbidden, while a slogan advertised, "This establishment protected and sanitized by Ace Cremation Service." Sully must have sensed my outrage. She put a hand on my sleeve, speaking in a low voice, "Don't make a fuss." "But it's..." I kind of strangled in my search for the right words. Not racist or sexist, certainly, or even speciesist. Life chauvinism was all that came to mind, an irrational and bigoted preference for the animate over the rotting deceased. How unevolved. "Never mind," she urged, slipping me a tattered sheet of paper. "Just get the things on this list, will you? We'll wait around the corner in that alley over there." She gave me a pretty smile that must have been lethal when she was alive, and Mulder stuck up his remaining thumb in a friendly gesture as they both turned to go. The proprietor sent me a sour look as I entered the store with list in hand. I felt certain there must be a word in their language for my kind, the sort who fraternizes with pariahs, and I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. In both Earth and demi-history, there were plenty of shameful periods when fear conjured odious, illogical prejudices. Level 18 worlds often had plenty. In the overall context of time, it could be viewed as just another natural phase along this planet's hard road to maturation. Indeed, the standards had some genuine reason for their fearful prejudices. Natural or not, I hated it. I mentioned that the clothing fashion among standards ran toward bulky pseudo-Victorian attire with high necklines for both men and women. The store offered an assortment of what at first I took for pet collars, studded with sharp spikes, till I saw a sign, "For a restful night's sleep." It made me wonder what they used as pillows here. The shopping list was fairly easy to follow. I nanos scanned my field of view as I looked around the store, highlighting matches with the letters on Sully's paper. For example, I quickly found Slim Faust, the liquid soul food. Also into the basket went vials of cosmetics and preservatives, like those she used that morning. For myself, I chose the blandest of food products, a loaf of plain brown bread and some yellow fruits, like bananas that smelled pretty good. My hand hovered near a box of breakfast cereal. The illustration looked cheery enough at first, featuring ravenous kids surrounding a giant bowlful of what looked like grinning Viking heads. "Canutes and berries, it's Grendelicious. Eat it slow or Beowulf it down." I vowed to have a talk with whoever programmed my nano translators, if I ever made it home. On impulse, I threw in a cheap brown jacket and one of the doggy collars. I'd surely be able to repay Sully, if not when we reached Professor Ping, then upon being reunited with the clever gamble. Perhaps Commander Healer Paolim could even do something about the conditions Sully and her friend were in, though I could hardly imagine how. A clump of many-colored plastic coins fell on the counter from her handbag when it came time to pay. While picking through the grimy pile, the clerk looked at me with disgust, as if to say, "Are you sure you have a pulse?" I'm all but certain he shortchanged me, but how could I protest? I didn't know the local coinage, and he'd have me dead to rights. Taking up the bag of purchases, I left the store and turned right, seeking the alley where Sully and Mulder said they'd await me. I reached the corner, holding out her list. "I hope this is everything you wanted." Staring, I realized that my two dear departed friends were gone. In their place stood a lanky man, wearing what looked a lot like a trench coat and battered fedora. Poking around, he used the toe of one shoe to nudge something small and smoldering, perhaps a bit that had fallen off of Mulder. It didn't take demi-instincts to know a cop when I saw one. "Shall I just step forward and introduce myself? Work my way up the ladder of officialdom? Take me to your leader?" As the fellow bent over to examine the sight closer, his coat parted, revealing a vicious-looking gun strapped to one thigh, almost certainly not set to stun. Holstered alongside were several wooden stakes and a hammer. "Maybe the authorities aren't my best option right now," I pondered and started to back away, only to collide with a wall that hadn't been there a second ago. I turned swiftly to find myself looking up at a formidable figure dressed in police blue. Shiny buttons spanned a chest that seemed almost as broad as the alley. But that wasn't the biggest surprise. The face grinning down at me was suddenly familiar. Crewman Wems? The demi-security man kept smiling, but something struck me as wrong. Not the layer of makeup that gave his face, like mine, an imitation local greenish tone. No, it was the teeth. Several were crudely capped, I realized suddenly, in order to make them look less pointy. "Hello, Professor," Wems said, in a low and friendly tone. That is, it seemed friendly, till he whipped forth a truncheon the size of a tree branch and used it to rap me sharply on the head, ending that brief morning and bringing back the night.